here at all with Municipal Sustainable Energy Forum, and our topic today is discussing some of the issues related to renewable energy on agricultural land. Our first speaker is Jeff Hansky with Clean Focus, followed by Richard Chase with Chase Systems, and then our Hardy Arian with SunTech Power Development. So, Jeff, why don't you go ahead and start? And we're going to keep the introductions to one sentence, so it doesn't take us much time.
Yeah. Okay, but thanks, Kara. Yeah, this is Jeff Hinsky from Green Skies, Clean Energy, and Clean Focus. We are kind of sister organizations, but basically operate as one company. We are a CNI focused solar developer based in the Northeast and the West. Most of our activities is in the Northeast New England area, down the Eastern Seaboard a little bit. And
One sentence.
Okay. And
no, secondarily, we can't take up that much time. It took up too much time.
I understand.
Okay.
We have developed a number of projects on agricultural land over the course of the last 7 or 8 years, but I would say certainly over the last 2 years, this has been sort of de-emphasized and kind of for a number of reasons, not the least of which it is getting harder and harder to get siting approval, permitting, land use approvals for agricultural land, particularly in the Northeast. In fact, some states have either almost explicitly forbid it or made it so difficult to get permitting that makes it really difficult to develop greenfield projects. That being said, there is still some activities going on, and what it's kind of morphing to is smaller, less productive portions of larger agricultural areas. Maybe a 10-acre carve out on a 80-acre site that is either fallow or has not really been used very actively. In some cases, you can get those type of projects permitted. And then the other thing that is starting to happen that is we're watching very closely and have some early activities in is there is a few states in the Northeast that are encouraging or actually even give you some financial incentive to develop what is broadly being called mixed use or dual use type of projects. And this is either something as simple as, for example, the Massachusetts SMART program has an adder to the incentives for what they call pollinator-friendly development. And so fundamentally, it's planting on a greenfield site, plants that would attract pollinators, and mostly that's bees, but also some types of butterflies and things like that. So that's a pretty straightforward kind of addition to a project that broadly doesn't increase costs very much. And the adder is also relatively small, but it's something that make some sense. And then the other more dual uses, there are some incentives, although I'd say monetarily it's not so much yet, but I guess it's more around the permitting and siting issues of true dual use. So the ability of putting crops of various types on the same fields that the solar is located. Particularly in general, this may include having different type of mounting for your solar, installing it at taller or higher, so that does increase the costs more. But potentially for the farmer, it also gives them the ability to continue to generate revenues from their crops as well. And just one last comment along those lines, and then I'll turn it over. And one of the interesting things with this is sort of a quandary I think that states and certainly farmers are facing. Very often, the revenue that they can generate from leasing their land to a solar developer like ourselves is greater than the revenue they can generate from any kind of agricultural crop. You know, other than some very specific type of crops, you know, if particularly if it's not the most productive farmland, and so it's sort of a secondary crop that's being grown there, the revenues from solar is likely going to be greater than the revenues from the crop itself. And so there is a pretty strong financial incentive, and this is where some of this split use or the carving out of land is sort of being driven, that, you know, this incremental revenue that's a steady source of revenue really helps buffer sort of these larger or medium-sized family-owned farms that, you know, kind of are at the whims of the agricultural market. So, you know, I think this is going to be an ongoing sort of source of battle where the state conservation people want to keep all agriculture land out of development. Yet in the long run, it might be the most beneficial thing to keep the majority of agriculture land, you know, in agriculture. So with that, I'll turn it over.
All right. So, Richard, do you want to go ahead? And again, we have to keep the introductions to one sentence.
Sure. This is Richard Chase. My company is Chase Systems. I've consulted with a number of solar developers and in the Northeast. And with that, we've done a number of projects. We had, as Jeff had noted, a farm that had a couple pieces of land, which the farm had been in operation for four generations, and they'd never done anything with a couple parcels of land for obvious reasons. Once you looked at the land, it had boulders the size of a desk to the size of a car. So we ended up with that. Clearly, it didn't have much agricultural value, or they would have used it substantially before. Another project was, as New Englanders may remember, we had a tornado come through from Springfield through central Massachusetts, and there was a nonprofit organization who had a summer camp. Well, that tornado went through, demolished the camp buildings, tore down the trees, and so the nonprofit, which was already struggling, now had the cost of cleanup because they were required to clean it up because of a fire hazard of all this dead trees and debris. So we ended up buying the back piece of the land, which had almost no market value, and built solar there. And we took another piece of land that was part of a farm that had gone out of production, and the land was disturbed, as it's called in the business. It had been partially mined. The timber had been stripped off it. The sand and gravel had been dug out of part of it. It was growing basically invasives and coyotes. So there was no practical value of agricultural purposes in that land. I've seen any number of other parcels. Jeff mentioned the value of agricultural crops in central Massachusetts is so low that farmers just aren't bothering. And so there's a tremendous amount of fallow land. And yes, in theory, you would like to keep that in agriculture, but if the numbers don't work for agriculture, the farmer isn't going to do it. So another fun fact is one of the methods of dual cropping, if you will, is grazing animals. Now, you want to graze sheep because anatomically, sheep can only eat when their head is down. You do not want to use goats because goats can chew in any direction, including up. including your wires and so on and so forth. And the rule of thumb is sheep are about one sheep per megawatt. That was just a fun little fact as we were looking at one project, because now you have a nice fenced area where the coyotes and so forth aren't able to easily get in, and which makes it, you know, a number of acres, and you can put in a small flock of sheep, and your ground cover is all nicely maintained for the summer. So that's one of the fun things. We typically avoided productive farmland just because it would be preferred, if it is productive and worthwhile, they can keep it in farming. But if you've got the unproductive land, then yes, do something more productive with it, or grow mushrooms underneath, or cranberries. A number of creative solutions have been applied. Cranberries apparently grow very nicely under solar panels that are raised a little higher. So that's my thoughts on it. So I'll turn it back over to you.
All right, well, I guess you people probably didn't think you'd be learning about sheep versus goats, but I thought that was pretty interesting. So, you never know. So, Artie, do you want to talk a little bit about solar development on agricultural land or renewable energy?
Yes, thank you, Sierra. So, Artie Arian, 15 years in the industry, was mainly involved in the engineering and construction, and since last year, more in the development and investment of DG solar plus storage projects. So we are most of the time working on agricultural land, but I already heard a lot of things that I can confirm. So one thing that is absolutely right, we avoid prime farmland. Prime farmland is definitely not, you don't get any permit and it doesn't make any sense and it's not in the interest of anyone. So, but there is lots of other land around that is mainly used for grazing. So most of the land that we are developing right now here all over California is grazing land, and that means we are taking a portion out of the grazing land. They have lots of land. So just one example, it's about 560 acres in Marin County, and that we are just using about 20 acres for a smaller solar site. So that is only a portion, and that even allows with the Williamson Act, if some folks are knowing what the Williamson Act is, the contract of the conservation department. So we can go for the compatibility of that kind of solar development on this kind of contracts as even possible. And yeah, absolutely right is also that you can still continue the area for the grazing, but better for sheep, not for cows or goats. That will be not a good idea. But sheep works very well, and we know many projects that are doing that right now. It's a great idea. There is also some thoughts on agrivoltaics. Most of the projects right now are in Europe. Agrivoltaics, you combine kind of agriculture with solar on the same land. We have not done any of that, but we are looking at it. We are doing some, putting some thoughts into that, having discussions with stakeholders, and see if we have a chance to start some kind of a development like this. I think basically the thought of agriculture is a great opportunity to start thinking about more development on those areas that are not so much used as of now for really farming. They are more zoned for agriculture. And DG, solar plus storage, especially when it comes to resilience. As of now, we are here dealing with a lot of wildfires. We are dealing with lots of blackouts. So many problems. And our power system here in California. We believe into the transformation to DG solar plus storage, which will definitely bring a big benefit to the community and would allow the community as well to get more independently power at the distribution level and be more independent from the transmission level. That's basically our thoughts on the development.
All right. So I would be interested to know on the areas that prohibit development on agricultural land, do they allow it on non-tillable land? Jeff, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess the complicated answer is it really depends, and it depends a lot on this particular state policies, in some cases local policies. You know, there's, you know, in Massachusetts and Connecticut, there's land that's designated prime agricultural, and that's nearly impossible to get permitted. And then there's sort of a secondary category, which may actually be used for farming or for some agricultural purpose, more likely grazing than anything else, that you could probably get permitted. And so while it may not really be, you know, non-tillable, it's certainly not the most productive or the most, you know, the highest value use. You know, and there's other places. You know, I don't know that there's – I can't think of any place where there's truly a prohibition on farmland development. And it mostly comes down to policy and how aggressive the policies are, either by not offering incentives or reducing the incentive amount on what would be, you know, farmland. You know, and again, using Massachusetts as an example, you know, if you're on prime farmland, even if you could get it permitted, you don't get any incentive. And so it just makes the economics not work. And this kind of goes back to what we've, you know, several of us mentioned, the idea that there are, you know, you can have a 100-acre farm and they may be two or three, you know, 5 or 10 acre parcels of it that aren't very productive. And, you know, a while back we did a project in California for a farmer basically to use for his irrigation, for his pumping or whatever. And, you know, he had what ended up being about a 5-acre territory or plot that was an old retention pond that they used to use to capture runoff during, you know, fertilizing events and things like that. Now, that practice has been stopped long ago, but it was like a 5-acre retention pond that couldn't be used for anything. You couldn't grow crops on it. You know, you could park equipment on it or something if you wanted. And basically, we worked with them to, you know, work that area and flatten it out and build on that. So it was in the middle of 1,000 acres of, you know, lettuce and broccoli and things like that. You know, we built a 1-megawatt solar project. And so, you know, that kind of stuff, I think, with smart development, you can make these kind of things happen. But, it's really a state by state, in some cases county by county or local jurisdiction when it comes to permitting what they allow or don't allow, or make very difficult, I guess, is often the case.
All right. John Walter, do you have any comments about this? Any experience in that area?
A little bit. We've done a little bit of work here. We're smaller, but I'd like to ask the gentleman if they've done anything with moving water, either driving, pumps for moving water. This would be probably before the meter instead of big tariff projects. And these, of course, are smaller than probably what you deal with. But water in California is critical, of course. And in one case, we put in a DC pump so we could power the pump directly from solar with just a controller. Anyway, interested in any thoughts?
Yeah, this is Jeff. We've never done anything with water or, you know, run of the river kind of stuff or whatever. It's not a very active area. I know there are some things that are going on in that space, but we don't get involved in it.
Of course, you get water out there in the east.
Yes, we do get water. We the trend currently is removing dams, old dams, because of the hazards they provide. And in Massachusetts, by state law, a dam operator is legally, statutorily, has unlimited liability for...
Oh, whoa.
Dam should fail. I don't want to be a dam operator. I've been told that, and so I went and actually looked it up, and right there in the state law, you're unlimited liability. Now, it's interesting, the mention of solar driving DC pumps, and apparently in Afghanistan, the sales of solar and DC pumps to irrigate opium poppies is apparently going gangbusters. Because what they're doing is they put up a solar array in the desert, they dig themselves out a pond, they then fill the pond and use that to irrigate opium poppies.
Oh, an opportunity.
An opportunity. So, from the solar pumping, it makes a lot of sense if you need water for your agriculture. It's a very good one because, of course, your efficiency is really quite good. But here the trend is, and I do know some people that have and own dams and are generating hydropower, refurbishing old dams and old hydropower setups. But it's a very niche market, and they are getting squeezed. In the big picture, of course, we know about the tar sands in Canada, and they built 3,000 megawatt gas turbine plant generating plants to power the tar sands operation. The tar sands operation are shut down, as we all know, because the price of oil is too low. So what they're doing is running the natural gas that comes off of the tar sands fields. They're running those plants, and they're feeding that into the Canadian electric grid, which is then displacing load there, which is then driving Hydro-Quebec power down into the northeast U.S. and depressing wholesale prices here rather dramatically. So this is a very interesting situation, that our wholesale price is running 3 to 4 cents a kilowatt hour.
Wow.
With no end in sight. I mean, there's natural gas plants. The nuclear power plants are, a number of them, shutting down or not relicensing because they need higher rates than that just to break even. And coal is, I think we have 2 coal-fired power plants in New England. One has already stated that they're going to be shutting down, and the other one is they're hedging their bets. So it's an interesting scenario.
Yeah.
And, of course, the other side of it is the solar behind the meter makes all kinds of sense. But to be generating power on a in front of the meter in the wholesale market is really rather tough to make any money.
Yeah, sounds like it.
Other thoughts?
Well, we'll take some questions if there are any.
Yeah, this is Jeff. Just to add the comment about front of the meter and behind the meter, I mentioned that California project, and a number of states have these kind of rules. But as I mentioned, it was 4 driving irrigation pumps, and I forget the exact number, but it was something like 12 or 14 pumps, and each one of those pumps was individually metered. But California has a rule that you can do meter aggregation on adjacent parcels. And so even though the farm fields were, from a tax perspective, were different parcels, or, you know, historically were different parcels, the 1 megawatt solar array could feed, as I mentioned, 14 different meters in offset load on all of these meters and be treated effectively as a behind-the-meter project, because, as mentioned, you wouldn't be able to do it otherwise, or the economics wouldn't make any sense if it was really a front-of-the-meter kind of scenario. So, again, it depends a lot on local policies and restrictions of what works and what doesn't work. But, you know, there are creative ways to do it, and a number of states have abilities or treat agricultural type of projects that are behind the meter differently than they treat, you know, other, allowing these kind of meter aggregation scenarios.
Jeff or others, this is John Walter again. Are any of you using batteries in ag pump environments to reduce load charges?
We haven't yet. This is Jeff. We haven't yet. It is, you know, an area of interesting concern, particularly in the places with the big demand charges. And so it's something that we're kind of poking around, but we haven't done any projects yet.
Certainly the storage is something that's being looked at a lot. There's some going in now. Not that I've been involved with, but we have some very large demand charges in some of the territory that we're in. And in some cases, it just makes sense to put in the storage, never mind the solar, because the energy rates aren't that bad, but the storage charges will kill you if you've got a business with the right or the wrong type of equipment.
Right.
Mark Scully, do you have any thoughts about Connecticut?
Only comment I would make is the organization that I'm with, People's Action for Clean Energy, a nonprofit, we recently did a webinar on the responsible siting of solar, and we looked at it. We had a couple of considerations. One of our speakers, by the way, was from Green Skies, a clean focus company. They helped us walk through some of the considerations of siting large-scale solar. And we had a fascinating presentation by a woman named Lexi Hine, and she runs a business in upstate New York, leasing or basically providing the sheep for solar farms to graze under solar farms. They even have a strand of grass that they sell called Fuzz and Buzz. But she's an interesting resource because she's actually doing it. She's actually running a business doing this, so I can share that information with you, Sierra.
Talk about an entrepreneur.
I had a question. This is James Ornstein, and I'm from Texas, but the question is actually, I participated in something called the National Community Solar Partnership. And somebody there asked, he says he's having trouble siting a project in northern New Mexico, and he's looking for examples of solar projects with cattle grazing. So I don't know if anybody has any recommendations about that.
Yeah, this is Jeff. We haven't done anything that I can recall anyway that had anything to do with cattle.
Nor have I. Although I understand that the number of head of cattle per acre in a dry environment like that is a very small number of cattle. It would seem. Well, depending on how big a solar you're looking at developing, it would be an interesting case to look at.
Well, and wouldn't you just have to have a higher structure? I mean, wouldn't it be more expensive to put the cattle are just a lot taller than sheep? I mean, you need to put them up a lot higher.
Yeah, this is already
higher. Or you could
go ahead, Artie.
And do that.
Yeah. Go ahead, Artie.
Sorry. Okay, thank you. Yeah, this is Artie. I would say with cattle, you have to definitely go higher, about 10 feet, and the cost will increase on the structure. It depends on, you just mentioned, how big the site can be. If you can increase the megawatts and you have something maybe of a couple more megawatts, 2, 3, or better, 5 megawatts, that would helping you for the volume on to reduce the cost. You just get some economic scale in. In general, it's possible, but it also depends on what will be at the off-taker agreement, how high the PPA rate can be negotiated.
And this is John Walter out here in the West. I'll also throw out that if they're, and I assume by the question they're looking to graze the cattle underneath the structure, if that's the case, they need one hell of a strong structure or really small cattle. Because the cattle will rub up against the structure and they'll bend it.
Ah, there's a good reason. So this is David Duperreau in California. And maybe I missed it, but has anyone talked about the use of solar along with natural or sustainable methane on ag land is there any synergy there, and then also with hydrogen?
Well, I guess I would look at the methane or hydrogen as an energy storage type of process. The problem is that for hydrogen, the electrolyzer efficiency is not very good. Although when the price of electricity goes negative, which certainly it does a fair amount in Texas, it's gone negative in New England a small number of times. I guess the efficiency isn't so important because an electrolyzer is not an expensive piece of capital equipment. So that's another perspective. The methane, I guess, what would you be doing with the methane? Would you be feeding it into a pipeline? Would you be burning it?
Well, that's what I'm asking about, is the synergy, converting it to, I mean, you need a fuel source for to convert to hydrogen. I don't really understand the technical aspects of it very well. I just know that there have been discussions of these synergies, and I just wondered if folks had thought about that.
Right. The spare electricity could be used to create hydrogen. It could also be used to create ammonia, which ammonia is, of course, can be used as a fertilizer. It can also be used as a fuel for internal combustion engines. Problem is, it's very corrosive to the equipment, as is things like landfill gas. One of the projects I've worked with takes the gas from a large landfill, processes it, and then they were running it through some Capstone microturbines and using the waste heat in the processing of the sewage treatment plant, which is immediately adjacent to the landfill. The turbines didn't last anywhere near the expected lifespan, in part due to the landfill gas. And so they ended up just taking the gas, keeping the upgrading plant, which raises the BTU content, and then burning that for the sewage plant seems like the most cost-effective thing to do. So it was a nice cogen system that didn't quite live up to expectations.
I think in terms of RD here, in terms of renewable natural gas power generation, there is a way to just increase generation time. So if you have solar installed, then obviously, and you have no energy storage, you would have during this, the daytime the electricity, but you could then continue with combined with somewhere next to at the farm to get the sources, you could generate RNG, and then you have more generation. Maybe you have an idea of 20 hours generation over the whole year. That could work very well also for resilience. Like, we haven't done anything. We just thought about it, and we think that's a great idea to do so, but there is no real project so far.
Myra, do you have anything to add to this conversation? Oh, I guess not. Anybody else? Evan?
I know of a PV project that's thinking about something to add with a biogas component, but it's all very preliminary, just studying the feasibility roughly. It's a very large PV plant. I think it may be as large as 400 megawatts eventually, but would start out something less than 100 and might try a R&D project to add some biogas component.
What would they be doing with the biogas?
Making fuel actually, the initial idea is to make hydrogen, which would initially not have a market close enough for such a small amount, and therefore would be used to upgrade the CO2 out of a anaerobic digestion plant, upgrade the CO2 to methane using the hydrogen. So you'd have a greater amount of methane, and that's a storable, transportable fuel as compressed natural gas.
And that would be clean. That would be clean gas rather than the dirty gas that the bio that from like a landfill or sewage plant, right?
Right. You wouldn't have the sulfur problems.
Right. The biogas is the, at least from what I've seen in Boston, they have the MWRA, the Massachusetts Water Resources Board Authority, which runs a very large regional sewage plant on Deer Island. And that runs in the 90% of their thermal energy needs are met by the biogas coming off the waste in the digesters. So it's fascinating that the amount of electricity and oil consumed is far smaller than you would expect.
What's the name of the site again?
Deer Island. Mm-hmm. And so you can see it when you're flying in and out. And it's been used as a movie set a number of times. So it's quite interesting. They have a couple wind turbines because they're out in Boston Harbor. You know, Massachusetts inland, there's only a very small number of marginally decent wind sites. But you get 5 miles offshore, and there's a glorious wind source, wind resource. So that's all.
Myra, I see you're back. Do you have anything to add to this conversation?
Well, being with Ohio State University Extension, what we're doing is we're working with landowners, primarily in Ohio, to educate them about leasing with developers. But large-scale solar is pretty huge in Ohio. We've got 12 solar energy facilities being built or in the planning stages, and it's going to cover about 16,000 acres. Primarily in southern Ohio, and one very large one in, which is 5 square miles in Hardin County, which is northwest Ohio. One of the things we work with the property owners about is that, you know, and there's obviously benefits and detriments on this, but we work with them to help them understand what the implications are going to be for long-term agriculture. Because basically, with the leases, the farmland will be taken up for 2 to as long as 4 decades. Oftentimes, the farmers are very interested in leasing at least part of their land. If they have huge acreage, they'll continue to farm some of it, and the other will be under lease to the solar developer. The advantage to them is that many of these farmers are older. Their children don't want to continue to farm. With commodity prices and everything else, they have very thin margins. So at least entering into a lease for a portion of their land brings them some guaranteed income for a certain period of time, which enables them to continue to farm, and also in some cases is an incentive for their kids to come in and farm. In terms of local communities, we have, and I'd be interested to hear what other kinds of things exist in other states, but we have a pilot program. It's payment in lieu of taxes. So what it does is the company will provide money directly to the county, and it's up to $9,000 of megawatt of nameplate capacity. And the communities often that receive this are, if you're looking at southern Ohio, a very poor area, and marginal farming also. And so what they're seeing is they're able to take that money and put it into local services and into the schools and that sort of thing. So it really does provide a benefit to the community.
I'd say that's great.
That's Ohio.
Depending on where you are, you may have some wind resources as well.
Oh, absolutely, we do. In northwest Ohio, there's quite a few large wind farms.
Yes. In New York State, that's known as the Farmers Retirement Program.
It is in Ohio, too.
Yes. The other thing, depending on what scale you want to do, you can actually build a... call it equipment shed out of solar panels, and that can provide basically one house worth of power on a yearly basis. Or an EV, you build a second one and you can drive an EV roughly 9 to 10,000 miles a year.
That's great.
We're working, actually, some folks I know are working with farmers now, and they're building equipment sheds, as they're called, just because of the zoning ordinances and so forth. Equipment sheds are pretty easy to permit.
I'd like to get some information on that if we can reach out to each other, because I think that would be helpful in Ohio also with some of our farmers.
Yep. Because you generally don't want to leave equipment out in the weather, but if they're covered, it works out pretty well. So, yep. So that's one opportunity. And a farm, a good-sized farm, usually has enough space that they could do it in. New England, of course, we're quite hemmed in by small parcel sizes. And, of course, the other thing here is many of the feeders are now full with solar. And the utilities are getting fairly cranky, shall we say, about it.
Would you mind sending some material to Sierra, who can then distribute it to all of us about the equipment shed idea? I like that.
Okay, sure.
You just took the words out of my mouth. Sounds good.
Okay.
Yeah, we have some strange noise in the background here. Somebody's phone is not muted, I believe. Any other thoughts here?
Hey, Sierra, this is Chris Carrick from Syracuse, New York.
Sure, go ahead, Chris.
I'm wondering if folks are encountering the same challenge that I am, which is how prime ag lands are defined. We're a public regional planning agency, and we do a lot of work with municipalities on developing zoning laws that are, you know, friendly to solar but balance community interests. And there seems to be a growing trend, at least in upstate New York, about local ordinances, you know, prohibiting or severely restricting solar development on prime ag lands as defined by the USDA. But at least in our neck of the woods, a lot of this land is either, you know, not being farmed or put in alfalfa or pretty low value crops. And so, you know, a lot of these municipalities just cut copy paste from other municipalities with their zoning. But this seems to be a pretty big issue.
Yeah, this is Jeff. I'll amplify or reiterate that. Yeah, I mean, you know, as I mentioned before, you know, you often have agriculture land or land that's zoned agriculture. And
one second here, Jeff. We've got somebody mm-hmm. whose line is not muted, and I can hear a lot of background noise. So would you folks want to just make sure that your lines are muted? I think it's gone now. Okay, go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, so starting over, often you'll have a 100-acre farm, and the whole farm, of course, is zoned for agriculture. But maybe 70-80% is really being used for growing crops, and the other, you know, areas are just either, you know, not practical, either because of the rock and stuff that was mentioned before, or it's you know, just the soil itself is not very very productive. Yet the whole area is at agriculture or prime agriculture, and getting exceptions and land use exceptions for that kind of stuff is nearly impossible in most places. And it just becomes, you end up having to find, the few local jurisdictions that might be conducive to making these kind of exceptions to the overall, designation of the land. But it's not very easy. And so I think that is a real challenge, and, you know, whether you're using the USDA, designation or Massachusetts has their own designation of what's prime farmland and stuff, it's problematic.
I would completely agree. And, of course, if you go up in western New York, you'll find an awful lot of fallow land, or somebody's growing hay or corn, which in this part of the country doesn't bring much in terms of revenue net over cost of production.
You know, just to follow up on that, as a planner, you know, we've talked about smart growth forever, and there's been some great analysis looking at how counterproductive it is to convert farmland to residential subdivisions, for example, when you look at tax revenue generated versus demand on social services, schools, and so forth. I wish that SEIA or, you know, other solar industry groups would do a comprehensive analysis comparing, you know, the benefits from a public fiscal point of view of solar as compared to what we've seen for decades, which is farmers, you know, selling out to residential developers. Is anyone aware of anything like that happening?
Yeah, this is Jeff again. I'm not aware of anything like that where there's been the sort of financial analysis or, but we've had a couple of projects, interestingly, that had, you know, the individual farmer, and kind of they use that, you know, farmer's retirement plan kind of thing. The individual farmer basically presented an economic analysis that he had done basically that was more individual to him. And, you know, for our family, this means XYZ number of dollars. And the reality is, you know, my kids or grandkids aren't that interested in continuing to farm or want to do this as a small-scale kind of operation. And the alternative is turning it over to residential developers, you know, or some other way to monetize this thing. And, you know, solar, while it may tie up the land for 25, 30 years, housing is going to tie it up forever. And so if there's ever any expectation that you want to recover that farmland or, you know, there's a shift in the economics, then maybe it would make sense. You know, solar is probably in long run a better alternative as well. So, you know, with that, you know, being said, you know, there's, I'm not aware of any large scale or, you know, university level study of, you know, economic impacts versus one versus the other.
Seems like something.
But one would think so. Yeah. So, I have a question though. Would it require rezoning? Generally, does it require rezoning if you're going to continue to make it grazing land or grow some other crop, you know, cranberries or mushrooms or whatever? It's still in agricultural use, but also has the enhanced value and tax revenue or whatever of the solar.
Right. The tax revenue of the solar would be along the lines of the previous comment about a pilot or payment in lieu of taxes. So it would be simply a bonus, if you will, for the land. For the land is now generating the regular property taxes, which on agricultural land is pretty low typically, plus a payment in lieu of taxes.
Yeah, in Ohio we have what's called a CAUV, which is a tax break for farmers. And if their land is put into a solar usage, they lose the CAUV. So part of the economic analysis is, will there be enough benefit coming in to offset their increase in taxes?
Right. Massachusetts has a similar program.
Okay.
And yes, if the property, if it's used exclusively for solar, it has to be taken out of Chapter 61, as it's called in Massachusetts.
Okay.
And you have to pay back 5 years of that benefit, typically. So it's, unfortunately, discourages that act. Well, it's partly intended to discourage that activity. But
sounds like a legislative solution to that policy problem.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely.
I mean, here in New York, we've got, you know, fairly large houses, mansions, that are still getting the state's agricultural tax exemption because they have a pseudo farm still on portion of their property. But I mean, given that ag tax exemption, that doesn't bring anything into the towns. You know, converting part of a farm to solar is a pretty good opportunity for the municipality from a tax point of view.
Right. Right, and certainly the farmer, the part of the farm he would convert to solar is the least productive part. I mean, farmers are no dummies. They're going to do what is least productive and for anything else.
I have a pretty specific question, if no one else has any. It's about wildlife-friendly fencing, which has become a hot topic here in upstate New York, and debates over how high the fence should be, should you let the deer go in and out easily, and someone mentioned coyotes before. I'm wondering if any of the developers have thoughts on what the best practice is at this point.
It's a good question. I don't have an answer. I mean, we've usually fenced it with an intention to keep coyotes and larger critters out. But then again, yeah,
including people, that's part of the complication. If it's something big enough to let a deer in, you have the issue of potentially safety issues even of people getting inside. So, yeah, that's a tough one. I haven't really given it a significant thought.
Yeah, our deer can clear 6 feet pretty easily. So that's the debate is, you know, should it be 6 or 8 feet pretty much?
No, to let them jump over the top.
Well, you don't want a deer getting caught on the top of the fence, right?
Yeah.
And you use the solar-powered fence chargers, the deer fence, will corral the deer. They're sloped. They're not a vertical fence. They slope outward. So if a deer is browsing around and they lift their head up, they're going to get a shock, so they tend to stay away from it. That's what the vegetable farmers do to keep them out of the vegetables.
That's interesting. I haven't heard about that being done here.
Yep.
Well, guys, we are about out of time. The conversation certainly has ranged into territory I wasn't expecting, but it's very interesting all the way around. So, tomorrow we have another call, and it should be extremely interesting. Theresa Dobriansky will be talking about Peter Fox Penner's book. As I understand it, it's related a lot to microgrids. So she'll summarize that, and we have a panel of Larissa, Rick Brown, Baird, and Craig. You're going to be on the panel as well, I understand. So another good topic. Thanks, everybody, for coming. If you have anything you want me to pass on, send it to me today if you can. I will probably get an email out tomorrow with the recordings on it for this call today and tomorrow's call as well. So thanks, everybody. Thanks for the panel. Interesting discussion, and hope to see you all tomorrow.
Great. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks again, Tara.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.